and welcome to another exciting episode here at IT Pro TV. I'm your host, Mike Roderick. Today we're doing our CISSP, and specifically we're going to be getting into assessing and mitigating vulnerabilities. And we got vulnerabilities across a wide range of areas, and so we got Mr. Adam Gordon here to help us out and see where they are and what we can do to mitigate some of those vulnerabilities. Welcome, Adam.
Welcome indeed. So let's talk about assessing vulnerabilities. Specifically, we're going to talk about assessing and mitigating, in this case, vulnerabilities related to security architecture, design, and solution elements, and of course, always without exception, socks. Right?
Socks. Gotta have the socks if you're gonna mitigate vulnerabilities.
Socks. Cool socks. Orange and yellow and gray today. Vulnerabilities related to sock choice is what we're also going to talk about. All right, so all kidding aside, let's get into our conversations here. So we're going to focus on architecture. We've been talking about that for some time. It's been a theme, several of our episodes, how we build a secure infrastructure, how do we set up controls to do that, how do we identify risk, how do we shape and control behavior with policy. These are things we've been talking a lot about. We have to identify common threats throughout the organization, throughout the infrastructure, in order to be able to assess and mitigate vulnerabilities. We have to first identify potentially what they are. So what are areas where we may see threats in? This is obviously going to be a very important question for us to ponder as security professionals. So things such as hardware failure, right? Think about the fact that if you don't have redundant power supplies and you lose the power supply in your server, that particular solution is no longer available to your users till you fix that. What if you lose a network card? You don't have redundant network cards or a network team. So hardware failure can obviously be catastrophic. What if somebody is able to misuse their privilege? Their authentication allows them to get in, right? But then authorization gives them more privilege than they should have. All of a sudden, they have full access when they should have read-only. That can obviously lead to complications. What about things like denial of service? Somebody's able to launch an attack where they effectively can consume all of the resources in one or more systems, allowing them to take that system offline or impact availability. This would obviously lead to an issue and a concern. Hacking in general is obviously always a concern. You know, these are areas of common threats, and we have to be identifying key areas to focus on. As a result of focusing in on them, we could begin to craft not only the assessment regimes, but also the mitigation strategies that help us to prevent these things from becoming a reality. So when we think about system architecture, we have to think about emanations. This is one of the first areas we talk about. When we think about a computer system, much like the laptop I'm using, for instance, where I have my notes and I'm talking to you, this laptop, or any computer for that matter, any computing device, is going to radiate out beyond the boundary of the shell of the system. Electronic emanations, in other words, information is coming off of this system through electronic radiation, specifically what we call electronic signals, right, that you can pick up in effect and you can reproduce within a couple of feet of the machine, depending on the strength of the machine and certain parameters associated with how it's built. System emanations, in other words, can be a problem because if somebody's able to pick them up and reproduce them, they effectively can see the information on my screen, even though they're not looking at it. Now, this is not something that's normally done every day. This is not something that you could just walk up to a computer, sit down 5 feet away, point your computer at the screen and do. You need special equipment to be able to pick up this electromagnetic radiation and then reproduce it. But the point is, it can be done. It bleeds everywhere, and much like a wireless signal, it's there for the taking if you know how to find it. So in order to protect against emanation threats, we use something known as tempest shielding. And tempest shielding is effectively going to allow us to be able to use technology that will absorb the electromagnetic radiation, the emanations that come from the hard drive, the CPU, the memory. All electronic devices create this electromagnetic radiation. And as a result of that, tempest shielding absorbs it and effectively stealths the machine, prevents the radiation from seeping out and being read or being seen out beyond the boundary or the border of the device. We talk about a Faraday cage with regards to tempest shielding. Faraday cage is going to be a specific kind of protection device that uses tempest technology. You see this in secure systems where the computer device, whether it's the monitor, the CPU, the tower, all the device peripherals, the keyboard, the mouse, etc., the mouse pad, because let's not forget mouse pads are confidential purveyors of information. We must classify them along with the rest of the system. So we put the entire system in effect into a Faraday cage, into a shell. And this is a special metallic device that we effectively insert the system into. It is effectively going to look just like a cage that sits around the system. It absorbs all the electromagnetic radiation, preventing the information from seeping out beyond the cage. So you see this in secure networks. It's not something you would run into every day. But when we talk about protective shielding, we talk about Tempest technology, and we talk about Faraday cages, specifically dealing with emanations, electromagnetic radiation coming off of the box. We also have to think about knowing a little bit about or think about the concept of what's known as a state attack. A state attack, or attacks that deal with the state of the system, are going to also commonly be called race conditions. You may hear them referred to in that way. This takes advantage of effectively how a system is able to process or handle multiple requests. So, for instance, let's say that I ask Mike. Mike's going to be our equivalent computing device in our example here. So if I ask Mike to do three things for me, Mike, I need you to go open the door, get me a glass of water, and also bring me back a double espresso, right? So if I ask Mike to do those three things, and then Mike goes and opens the door and then gets the espresso and comes back in before he brings back the water. If you remember, I said open door, get water, get espresso in that order. If Mike brings me the espresso, forgets the water, has to go back and get it again, he's executed those requests out of order. The way in which those execution requests are carried out by the system, the way in which we see the information showing up, and the ordering or sequencing of those requests can be examined. And if we then are able to understand what happens in or out of sequence, we may be able to tell something about the system and how it operates. And if we can then divulge certain information or derive and effectively understand and analyze the system to see certain information as a result of that, we can then begin to form a mechanism or a thought process around how we may attack the system. So race conditions look at the order in which CPU processing takes place, the order in which effectively requests are carried out. I just want to note for everybody out there, for the record, Mike has not gone and gotten me my espresso yet. Just pointing that out. Just have a little bit of a failure of communication taking place here today, but that's okay. We're going to work through this. That's not a problem. All right, so state attacks are all about race conditions, right? We want to make sure we understand that a race condition is about the idea behind understanding how systems process information, what order they process in, and understanding that there may be valuable information we can derive by examining that and understanding that that may then lead us to be able to compromise the system. The mechanics of how that happens are not so critical for you. I know you may be excited to understand how that works. And I'm not suggesting you shouldn't research that. But let me be clear. We're not going to ask you to explain this kind of an attack on an exam. We're simply going to ask whether or not you are aware of it. And if you have to define it or apply the knowledge to a scenario, make sure you understand what it is. We're not going to ask you how to carry one out, in other words. This is not a practical hacking exam. This is an exam about information security management. So I just want to make sure you're aware of that. In addition, we talk about covert channels. Covert channels are going to be communication mechanisms, effectively, that are hidden from view, right? So if I'm able to communicate with somebody normally using, let's say, the phone, I pick up the phone, I call you up, we have a conversation, that's an understood, well-established, well-documented communication mechanism. It's not a covert channel, it's what we would call an overt channel. Obviously available and out for everybody to see in public view. A covert channel would be if nobody but you and I both knew that we each had a two-way pager. We'll reach back into the textbook of old school technology, right? For years, when I was in the music business, for years, I carried a two-way Sky pager. So you had the, you know, like the 1-800 number. You could call me. I still remember the number, by the way. And you could call me, and up to about four lines of text, you could send me a message. Because, you know, back in the 80s, right, back in the day, tell you how old I am, back in the 80s, when I was doing this, and I was in the music business, and I was, you know, working and doing all sorts of stuff, that was really the only way you get a hold of people. There were really no cell phones back in the early 80s. And if there were, they were incredibly expensive. You didn't really have them in the, you know, the way we do today, where everybody has one, because, you know, Apple has taken over the world. And so they said that that was important, and now everybody has one. But back then, you didn't have that. So an overt mechanism for communication back then would have been a two-way pager or a pager that you could page people on. Today, you know, you just don't have those things. I mean, I say a pager to my students, they look at me and go, "The hell are you talking about?" I also talk about rotary dial phones, and they're like, "You're a dinosaur. What are you talking about?" So, you know, a two-way pager would be an example of a covert channel. If only you and I, let's say hypothetically, were having this conversation and both of us had a pager and we knew each other's numbers, but nobody else did, and we could send each other information over the pager, but nobody else knew about that communication mechanism, that would be considered a covert channel, something that is secret, that's only known basically to one or maybe two parties that can engage in communication. When we turn that into the conversation about security in a system, what we're really talking about is something like a back door, something that is only known to maybe one individual, typically a hacker, that could take advantage of that, but may not be known to anybody else. So that's what a covert channel will be. And so we talk about specifically two kinds of covert channels. The TCSEC, if you remember the orange book that we defined as part of the Rainbow series, was the TCSEC. The TCSEC is going to define for us, or did define for us, two specific covert channels, storage channels and timing channels. So storage covert channels are ways in which we communicate through storage mechanisms without anybody knowing. So can we use white space or slack space in the drive to effectively hide information and make it available to a hacker that may use it to control the system, as one example. If you're not familiar with white space or slack space, this is the area of the hard drive that is where we can store information, but is not available typically to the file system. So we don't show you that information when you open the file explorer. It's there, in other words, but you're not able to see it with the graphical interface from within the operating system. So this is one of the ways we can do that. A timing channel, a covert timing channel, may have to do with the way in which we execute commands, as we were talking about just a moment ago, where we talked about state attacks and race conditions. A race condition is an example of using a timing channel, a covert timing channel, to execute an attack. So timing channels look at the way in which we execute information or we execute processes. Is there a way to get in there? Is there a way to modify that? Is there a way to control that? And is there a way to tell what the system function is and therefore weaknesses as a result of looking at timing? These are the two covert channels that are accepted and defined, and you should be aware of them as two examples of covert channels. We also have to think about older technologies such as mainframes and thin client computing. Yet we still have mainframe computers around. They're not as prevalent as they once were, but we certainly still have a lot of them. Things like AS400s, for instance, if you work in that space, are probably very common for some of you in your data centers. So the idea behind that technology is that it has some advantages from a security perspective, right? All the processing takes place on that central computer, and we go to that mainframe system to get the data and to analyze and access it. In other words, we don't have copies of data laying around on local systems when we're working on mainframes. So it's easier for us to be able to secure the data and control the processing because it all takes place in one place, and we effectively just use front-end systems to access the data and interact with it. But it never stays on the front-end system. It is always resident there, and so on the back-end system, rather, on the mainframe. So as a result, because it's a centralized computing environment, we want to think about the fact that from an architecture and a security perspective, vulnerabilities there are significantly less than they would be in the modern decentralized computing systems that we have today, where on my laptop, I may have a complete copy of all the sensitive confidential data that exists in the organization, even though there's multiple copies up on a file server and in different places. I may also have a copy locally. If my laptop is compromised, that data is compromised, even though it may exist in four or five other locations and is securely stored there. So we have to think about the implications of a centralized versus decentralized architecture as part of the conversation here as well. When we talk about mainframes, we also have to think about middleware. Middleware is the bridging software that is often used today to effectively allow us to get to mainframe systems, but to use them with a web-enabled front end, some sort of web API or web interface that allows us to access the mainframe and to use the data there, but to use it with modern computers and modern programs, when in effect the mainframe was really designed to be working in a very different kind of computing environment. Dumb terminals or thin client computers would have been used years ago, and they really would have run a very minimal operating system, and they would have just really been probably a command shell environment, not a graphical interface. I don't know if you remember years ago, I'm going to date myself horribly here again. But when I was going to college back in the 80s, we won't tell you what part of the 80s, but it was earlier rather than later. But when I was in college in the 80s, and I would go back and go and do research, or I'd turn papers, things like that, when I was working on my degrees, I would go to this mythical place. We used to call it a library. It's a beautiful place, boys and girls. They don't exist anymore. It was a collection of books that you could actually take out and hold in your hand and read, not electronic devices that you used to read books on the way we do today. So I would go to the library to do research, as many people did, and I'm sure some of of you still do. But when you went to the library, the card catalog, right, if you went to an earlier version of a library, the original version, was all actual physical cards. That's why they call that a card catalog. And you had it in all these long filing cabinet drawers, and you would look up using the Dewey Decimal System, another great invention that has come and gone. You would use the Dewey Decimal System, and you would look up your book, and then you would go search for it in the stacks and see whether it was there or not. But then they converted all that into basically an online card catalog. And so the mainframe system that would host that was this massive computer sitting somewhere, a VAX system, whatever it was, and you would have these dumb terminals, these green CRT or amber CRT screens, right? The kind you would see at doctor's offices years ago as well. And you would go and type in what you wanted, and it would go search in the mainframe and bring it back. So the middleware that we use today effectively takes that system and brings it into the modern world by giving you the ability to interact with it using like a Windows graphical environment to be able to get to the data. This is what middleware does. Middleware is good, but the problem is middleware is software. And like any software, there potentially are bugs and vulnerabilities inherent in it. And we have to understand that and be aware of that as we look at and assess and mitigate ultimately vulnerabilities within these systems, right? Embedded systems are another area we have to worry about. When you go and you go to a retailer and they are going to be able to provide some transactional data for you, you want to look up something in inventory. They have an embedded POS, a point of sale system they use at cash registers and things like that. So if you go to Home Depot, you go to Target, you go to Lowe's, you go anywhere, whatever these major retailers are, Best Buy, doesn't matter. When you go to any of them, right, the idea is that you're going to ask a sales associate, hey, do you have this? They look it up on their cash register / terminal. They're using an embedded POS, a point of sale system, right, in order to look it up. When you go check into a hotel, the reservation system that runs on the front desk computers is using an embedded POS, an embedded point of sale system, and an embedded operating system, probably a Windows system, and maybe Windows CE, version 6, version 7, whatever it is. It's pre-installed into that system and runs Windows, but it's a unique and stripped-down version of Windows that won't run on normal PCs because it doesn't operate the same way. It doesn't have the same capabilities, in other words. So embedded systems provide a very small set of capabilities and a small limited form factor and are used specifically to achieve certain results. In this case, be able to sell and process certain things, look up inventory, whatever it may be. Again, these systems may also have vulnerabilities that we have to mitigate. They have to be patched managed just like everything else does, but patching them will take a different form because we have to get certain patches from vendors in order to integrate them into the systems. There may be a issue associated with security in those systems with regards to user logons and authentication that we have to watch out for. In other words, if somebody doesn't log out of that system and we don't have a control in place that automatically session times out, then somebody can walk up and gain access to that system when you're not there. And as a result, they can potentially gain access to transactional data, they can manipulate inventory, all sorts of stuff. So what you often see in these systems when somebody walks away from a terminal, they have to log out specifically. They go through a logout process. They effectively zero out the terminal so it's not in use. Then you have to log back on. So if you've ever seen somebody walk up to a cash register, you know, there's a busy line wherever you are, and they walk up and they have to go through a whole setup process to bring the system up for you to then go and pay and have a shorter line. That's because they're logging back into the POS system and effectively activating the terminal. And so this is what we see with embedded systems. We have to be aware of this as well. When we think about all these kind of systems, we also have to bring mobile devices into the picture, right? Because no conversation about vulnerabilities and assessment and mitigation would be complete without talking about all the different platforms we have. We've spoken about mobile devices in certain areas already. We want to understand and think about the fact that when we talk about mobile devices, we may be talking about tablets or laptops. These will run common operating systems today that obviously we are well aware of, we can manage and understand. But we're also potentially talking about mobile devices such as phones, and we often call them smartphones today. And my question about smartphones is this, and I often see the irony in things, so I'm going to make an observation here. If they're so smart, why can't they manage themselves and never have a problem with security? I don't know. I'm just saying, you know, if they were that smart, they'd be able to do that. But since they're not that smart, we have mobile device management, and we have the ability to be able to do patch management and security mitigation on these devices through policy-based application of management solutions. And so we have to be thinking about the fact that in the mobile world, at least in the phone-based mobile world, we have at least four competitive systems that we have to worry about, right? We have BlackBerry today, we have Android-based systems, we have Apple-based systems, and we have Windows Mobile-based systems. So as a result, we have at least four different platforms in the handheld smartphone market that we potentially have to become aware of, understand, and figure out how to manage and mitigate security vulnerabilities for. Saw an interesting study in the last couple of days that came out about the potential looking ahead to some of the new technology advances in the iPhone platforms and things like that that are continuing to come out, the potential for security vulnerabilities on the Apple platform increasing as they continue to add new functionality and build out new things. You know, just the jump to biometric support alone has opened up potentially new vulnerabilities on the Apple platform. So the reality is, for everything we do, the more complex we make a system, the more vulnerabilities we often introduce into it. And this is something we have to think about as well. As we have an app for everything, as my children are often very fond of telling me, Daddy, there's an app for that. Yeah, I don't care about apps. I run BlackBerry technology. I don't use a lot of apps. I use a phone that's actually meant for business, right? As opposed to a computing device that is a consumer product that's meant for fun and games. But I'll get off my soapbox and get back to what we're talking about. So when there's an app for everything, right? We want to understand that apps in and of themselves are software programs, right? They bring functionality with them, but they also bring liability. They bring risk on top of the risk we already see in the platform. And we have to be thinking about all these things as we assess and mitigate vulnerabilities, because if we're mitigating the vulnerability on the phone by managing the operating system itself and patching that, but we're not mitigating and assessing the vulnerabilities in the compiled code, i.e. the apps that we are running, we've only done half the job. And as a CISSP, if we have corporate-owned devices that are being given to individuals in the company and we're not managing them effectively, we're allowing apps to run and be installed without our knowledge, we've effectively opened that platform up to compromise. And we see replete examples of this throughout time, where apps, even though they go through all the security processes in whatever vendor store, Google store, you know, the Android Play store, the iTunes store, whatever it is, even the Microsoft Windows store, all three of them have had security failures where apps have been certified only later to find out they contain malware. Nobody's perfect is my point, right? And I'm not suggesting any one vendor is better or worse than any other. But I am pointing out to you that if you rely exclusively on a vendor to do their job and you don't double check and verify, you're going to have a problem, because at some point they're going to get it wrong. And I'm not suggesting you may be able to verify the integrity and the lack of malware in an application. That may be beyond your capabilities. You may have to make some educated decisions about whether to trust the vendor or not and then hope for the best. But what I am suggesting to you is that if you don't have a plan, if you haven't thought through what will happen if something like that does occur and the vendor gets it wrong, and you're not prepared to react, you're going to have a significant challenge on your hands that's going to be worse than if you've already thought through the likelihood of the fact that the vendor may screw up and get it wrong. And as a result of that, what will happen when that does? You know, mitigation and assessment of vulnerabilities and planning to deal with them is not always about figuring out how to stop it before it starts. We have to accept a certain amount of risk. We've talked about how we deal with risk. You know, we can accept, if you remember, right? We can avoid, we can transfer, or we can mitigate. We've been focusing heavily on mitigation. I will continue to in some of our upcoming episodes in this particular topic area. But you want to keep in mind that if we're not going to avoid risk altogether, if we're going to allow users to download apps on mobile platforms, we're going to accept a certain amount of risk, because we may not be able to verify the integrity, and the likelihood that there is or is not malware in that particular app may be unknown to us at the time we allow the app to effectively be installed. We may have to wait and see, in other words. But if we're planning for ultimately what the bad outcome could be, you know, the Boy Scout motto, right? Always be prepared. So if we are always prepared, then the likelihood of that mitigation strategy going into effect quickly is a lot higher than you sitting around wondering what went wrong and why Apple or Android got it wrong and who you're going to blame. You could blame them all day. It's not going to solve your problem. The malware is still there and it's still spreading. So you want to think about that, keep that in mind, and obviously be aware of that as well. When we often talk about these systems and we think about vulnerabilities, we have to also think about what's known as a single point of failure. What is the key area, the weak link in this particular process chain that we have to focus on? Is it the fact that you only have a single power supply and a server, and that server may be your main file and print server? And if it's crunch time at the end of the month, you're generating reports, and that server gets overloaded, overheats, and fails, then that's a single point of failure for you. So anything that is not redundant potentially is a single point of failure. Make sure we know that. One of the things we often do, and we talk about in this regard, is carrying out what's called a single point of failure audit. going through your systems and looking for single points of failure and documenting and identifying them, and then figuring out whether or not you're going to offset them and mitigate them through creating redundant strategies. Things like the application of a RAID solution, for instance, some sort of technology, and we'll identify RAID levels at some point later, but using a mirroring strategy. RAID level one, for instance, is one way to create redundancy for information storage locally on a system. That would be a good example of dealing with a single point of failure if the hard drive or the controller were to fail within the system. You could do RAID or RAID 1 with duplexing, which would be both controllers and drives, right? I got that right, right?
Yes, you did.
Okay, awesome. I was really worried about that.
Yeah, I can tell.
Oh my God, what am I going to call that? Right, so you know, things like RAID 1 and duplexing would be good examples. We might have dual network cards. I mentioned that earlier with a NIC team. A NIC team is the joining of two or more cards together so that we can fail over to a card if one were to stop working for some reason. We might have redundant power supplies. We might have UPSs and backup scenarios for generation of power, things like that. All of these will eliminate single points of failure. Want to make sure you're aware of that. Also, keep in mind there's a human single point of failure element we have to think about and also understand and document. What if somebody's walking around with knowledge in their head that nobody else knows? Yeah, we talked about this with the Fred example, one of our earlier discussions when we talked about having a solution for a retention period that would match the expectation or the requirement of keeping the data secure. If we use 15-year-old technology to implement encryption or to build the system that's going to use that, and then 20 or 15 years later when we get to the end of the cycle, Fred, who's the engineer who built it, is no longer there and nobody got the info out of Fred's head, was the example. Fred is now the single point of failure because effectively nobody knows how to work that system anymore, and you effectively allow the information to escape the boundary of the organization and not be captured anywhere. So we can also have a human single point of failure. We want to think about that and be aware of that as well, right? We've talked about computers in general, desktops, laptops, all sorts of computers. All of them have the ability to have threats and vulnerabilities in them, and we have to mitigate and assess those threats and vulnerabilities, obviously. Are we running things like licensed operating systems? You know, not running pirated software, in other words, right? Very important, because pirated software, aside from being illegal, and obviously that's not a good thing at all, but aside from that, it usually has malware or some sort of spyware in it, so it's not just that you're breaking the law, which is obviously very bad, but it could also lead to infection of multiple systems, which can easily also be a problem. Do we have intrusion detection and intrusion prevention systems running? Are we using firewalls? Are we doing patch management? You know, these are all things we think about in this area with regards to desktops, laptops, servers, thin clients, things of that nature. We've talked about mobile devices extensively already as well, talked about server-based solutions. All these areas have to be brought to bear and really be part of the conversation we're having. We should also think about data flow and how data moves through a system with regards to assessing vulnerabilities and assessing and then ultimately mitigating them. Do we understand the data flow pathways? In other words, have we mapped out the data flow in our systems? Do we have what's called a data flow diagram? If we do, we should be able to, and I often see this when I go into customers, emergency operations centers or NOCs, or I walk into their offices, you know, they have the huge plotter printout on the wall, right? You know, they've got the 20 by 20 or whatever it is, and they've got the network map with all the servers and everything laid out. The routing guys or routing girls typically have that as well. They'll have the routing topology printed out and laid out. The web hosting and database hosting areas have their own, that kind of thing. You know, these are schematics. They're diagrams about how systems are wired together. What I don't often see, though, is the data flow diagram. How does data actually move through those systems? If we don't understand that, we also could have a vulnerability and a problem. If we're not creating multi-path redundancy, so data can flow through more than one pathway to get from point A to point C, that can be an issue. If we are using multi-path redundancy, but we are not implementing and testing and validating multipathing, but just assuming it's working the right way, we could have a problem. Had a customer that had a yearly annual failover event that they would use for testing purposes under regulatory law. They had to test failover at least once a year here in the United States during the financial and banking services industry. And so they were required to do a full-on interruption test at least once a year. So they went and did the test. This is the interesting part. Not that they did the test. It's what happened. So they did the test. They were able to fail the systems over to what they thought was their emergency operations center. Problem is, when they failed over, A, the traffic wasn't going to where it was supposed to. B, they couldn't fail back. And so when it happened, and it took 3 days to figure this out, by the way, so you can imagine the impact to their systems to finally figure out what the answer was. And the answer is often very simple. The problem is incredibly complex, but when we finally get down to it, it was actually a very simple answer, although the problem hid the simplicity of the answer for 3 days. What ultimately had happened was right before the failover and then the failure, they had gone through a patch cycle and an updated patches and firmware across their routing infrastructure. Cisco had put out a series of updates, and they had done that. Because of the nature of their failover topology, everything had to be patched to the exact same level, or things wouldn't work. You can see where I'm going with this, right? So they had patched, but they didn't patch to the same level across all the systems. And one of the systems that was critical in the middle of the path effectively was different than all the others and went off effectively into space and never came back. And it took 3 days of debunking and working with Cisco engineers to troubleshoot and figure out what had gone wrong. Because all the obvious things are the paths there, we're using deterministic routing, or all the static paths there, is everything up, we can ping all the interfaces, everything's working. All that was fine. They can move traffic back and forth in controlled conditions, but they couldn't fail it over and then bring it back. That was the problem. And they couldn't do that because one of the patches that had been applied, but was applied at a different level, had changed the nature of one of the ways in which this particular technology was supposed to work. And it was a minute change, but it was an important one. The failure there was not just doing that before a major failover event, but the failure was that they had not documented properly what patch levels were applied to every system. We've talked significantly in many respects about the value of documentation, how important it is, and why we have to keep up with it. So just want to think about that and be aware of that as well, right? So, you know, just keeping that in mind as we begin, and obviously in this particular case, start to wrap up our conversations in this particular episode, but we're going to have a lot more to say about assessing and mitigating vulnerabilities. So hopefully you're going to be sticking around for those conversations, and we'll have a lot of interesting things to continue to talk about.
Absolutely. I hope, you boys and girls, ladies and gentlemen out there, if your head is swimming like mine, it's a ton of information, a lot of vulnerabilities, kind of, I'm trying to think of a good way to say it, it's almost mind-boggling, and we're not done. We've got more to go over. So we're going to have to come back for a part two to finish up our assessing and mitigating vulnerabilities in our security architecture. Remember, if you guys want to see or attend one of Adam's classes, shoot us an email, cadam@itpro.tv. Signing off for now, I'm Mike Roderick.
I'm vulnerable, but I'm also sensitive. My name is Adam. Come back and join us for another conversation.
We'll see you soon.